most people think.
Episode 25 of What Most People Think. 25, and look, on the 20th, the quarter century episode, we're leaving the EU. It's really happening. It's happening as I record this on Friday of this week. And I know, look, I know not everybody wants it to happen, but isn't it better to just be getting on with the next chapter? No, Jeff, no, let's carry on. The indecision, indicative votes. Anyway, look, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. You got any parties lined up? Yeah, you're going to be bonging? You're going to be bonging? Big Ben bonging for blimmin' well British Bulldog Brexit? Or are you going to be doing some Euro parties? Farewell to the Euro parties. I think both those parties are kind of weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, because for me, leaving the EU was never massively ideological. You know, I think that it came from a place of patriotism and optimism. But yeah, you know, it's extricating ourselves from a political union. So it was not necessarily the sort of thing that I would have a party over. In the same way, I wouldn't have a party over changing my car insurance provider. You know, but I think the Euro parties, they're going to be a bit sad, aren't they? Because it's sort of going to be like a lot of Euro flags. And if they play European music, which would probably be a bit bad, you know, it's going to seem like a Eurovision, but without Graham Norton. And probably the UK getting more points now that we've left, finally. Or will we ever get a point at Eurovision again? Does it fucking matter? But yeah, it's going to change. And you know what? Anyway, look, I'll speak more about Brexit in a minute. Just to let you know what this podcast is. This is called What Most People Think. And it's about trying to get to the heart of, like, everyday people's views. You know, as I record this, there was the NTAs last night. And what always makes me laugh about those awards is that when you let the public vote, every once in a while, there's a result that just pisses off the industry. And every time Mrs. Brown's Boys wins, because obviously this year it was up against Ricky Gervais's sitcom, you know, and a lot of other shows that the industry would have liked to see get a recognition. But Mrs. Brown's Boys won again. Now, look, I think Mrs. Brown's Boys, I used to like it a lot. I think it's gone off the boil, but there's something fucking hilarious about watching people on Twitter lose their shit. That when, you know, in the British pub, yeah, they like an old-fashioned sitcom with laughs and pratfalls in it. You know, deal with it. Mrs. Brown's Boys is kind of like, you know, the comedy equivalent of Brexit. Is, you know, the establishment, they don't understand it, but it does have the numbers, right? But yeah, so, you know, it's kind of, that's where I'm coming from. I'm not saying, you know, this is the Mrs. Brown's Boys of podcast, so some people might see it that way. But yeah, we talk about politics and social issues and try and look at, you know, what are ordinary people thinking? Every so often we have a guest. I haven't had one for a while, but I had the opportunity to speak to Christopher Snowden. Now, Chris is he's a real libertarian, got real scrutiny on the nanny state, which obviously if you've seen my current tour, Taking Liberties, you'll understand that he's helped inform a lot of my thinking. And, you know, I mentioned the tour there. Why not talk about the tour for once? We got back on the road last Saturday in Newcastle, and thank you so much to everybody that came to that. That was fun, man. And the thing was, it was starting at 5 p.m. and I was sort of thinking, what are the audience going to be like? I mean, like, but, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, there's an old saying in comedy, is the more you drink, the funnier we get. So I thought, this is going to be really sober. And then I should have remembered, it's Newcastle. They're already drunk by 5 p.m, right? Let's do some regional stereotypes. They're already pissed. They've been on it since fucking breakfast. So the atmosphere was fantastic. We filled the room, 300 people. And the football was happening as well. There was Chinese New Year, and it just felt like a great day to be in the heart of Newcastle City Centre. And I would say about Newcastle as well, it's so great having the football, the stadium right in the middle of the city. I don't know if anywhere else has that. It's like this fucking cathedral. And just hearing the, anyway, I was going a bit sort of a Ron Manager there, you know, jumpers for goalposts, isn't it? Mm? But yeah, so the tour is back underway, and we are talking to Christopher Snowden today. And if you this chat, I think it's a bit like the Dominic Frisbee one. I don't know if you remember that from the summer about tax. You know, we have a good laugh and stuff, but you will feel a bit smarter by the end. So that's coming up shortly. But just a bit more on Brexit here. I think that the 50p thing was funny, wasn't it? I think the 50p coin has just shown how the extreme ends of the argument of both sides lost their minds, because it was only like a week or so previously where the Remainers were getting upset about the kind of rampant symbolism of Big Ben bonging this is ridiculous. You know, I thought it was supposed to be about leaving a political union. This is just kind of sentimental bollocks. And then you've got people like Alistair Campbell saying online that he will refuse any of the new Brexit 50p's. You know, he's just, he's a bit of a fall from grace from Alistair and Andrew Adonis. They're like, we're going to fight Brexit in the high courts. And now they're basically just handing back loose change to shopkeepers. It's a fall from grace. And I don't know, like, what, I think it's a bit weird, to be honest, the coin thing. I thought it was, you know, you've got to do something, right? You're leaving the European Union, you've got to do something commemorative. So what, is there a commemorative thing that they would have liked? Maybe it should have been something more ambitious, like a 50 quid note. Like, no one ever gets, 50 pound notes are still, they take your breath away. Don't they? Like, you just don't. And because of the way that we're more cashless now, in your whole life, like, you might, they're like the Northern Lights of notes, aren't they? You might not have seen more than 10 in your whole life. That is bizarre. Or maybe like a £2 coin. For me, £2 coins have never fully lost their novelty, right? I think £2 coins, I don't know if it's because the age I was when they were bought in once, weren't they? And then they sort of, there weren't many, and then, you know, with the whole two metals thing going on, they're like ice cream. I've never got over how much fun it is to eat chocolate ice cream. So maybe they picked the wrong coin. But, you know, it all feels weirdly chilled out, Brexit, doesn't it? When you think, like, how rancorous the argument was, you know, if you think back to, like, you know, the high-octane indicative votes, remember those? That was like the Champions League semi-finals, wasn't it, of Brexit? And then Super Saturday was what felt like the final, but of course it was another fucking postponement. But now it just, I don't know, it just feels like it's just going to tick over. And I know that we're, you know, going into like a transitional period, and that's part of the reason, and not much is set to change. But I do think going forward that it's going to be very hard for people to prove whether or not Brexit has been an objective success or failure, right? Because so much else is going to happen in the meantime. It's going to be sort of like your great-grandparents standing around a baby trying to say which one it looks like, claiming credit for it. You know, well, you know what? So much has happened. There's so many other fucking factors here. I don't know if it really does look like UFO. But yeah, for some people, obviously, you know, if you voted to leave the European Union because you wanted democracy to be closer to home, then it's already a success for someone like me. Like, if you, on the other hand, if you really prize freedom of movement, then that's a big loss. But there was something Caroline Lucas said, actually. She said she felt sad that, you know, her children and the nation's children, you know, it's one of these very emotive sort of lefty posts, that we were going to lose the right to live, work and love in the EU. And I sort of thought, well, okay, look, the EU have been guilty of a fair bit of overreach in their time. I'm not even sure the EU have slapped tariffs on love, right? I think you can still do that. I think you can still get visas. I think it's going to still happen. I mean, if you look at like where Brits tend to live, right? So you would say that, look, people live in the EU because of freedom of movement and because, hey, they're our closest neighbours. And then you look at where most Brits have chosen to go and live: New Zealand, Australia, Canada. Now, that could just be because they hate their fucking parents, right? Or their family, or they, you know, they're running away from, you know, sort of childcare issues. But childcare, that's not right, is it? No, childcare is just like having babysitters. That doesn't make sense. What, like they're a babysitter, 40 quid, and they've emigrated? No, I mean child support agent things. Now it sounds like I'm hiding something. But so, yeah, I think, like, everything in my life, right, that has been predicted to be like a dystopia or a utopia, it's going to fall somewhere in between, isn't it? It's going to fall somewhere in between. I just want to say a quick thank you to people that watched me on Would I Lie to You recently. That was so much fun to do. And thank you for anybody that tweets about it. When you tweet about stuff like that, it just does me a favour because, you know, I get enough stick as it is. And, you know, these TV producers, they sort of think it's Twitter is this online focus group rather than this fucking public forum for nutters than it really is. I also made my debut on The Pledge. And that was a lot of fun, man. Sitting there with Nick Ferrari, June Sarpong, Afua Hirsch and Michelle Dubry just shooting the shit. Hopefully I'll be back on that. But yeah, it was a good format, that. I enjoyed that. So like I say, if you ever you see me doing stuff on telly, tweet it, or, you know, use the hashtags, all that stuff, because it does do me a favour. So, but thank you to the people that are already doing that. I always do a thank you and a fuck you. The fuck you this week is to myself. I had a shot of turmeric the other day. Now, I don't know, you know, where you live in the country, but if you live in metropolitan areas, you have these shops that have things like a shot of ginger or a shot of turmeric, $1.99 a pop, right? But it's supposed to be healthful. I think for $1.99 a pop, I'm wanting more than fucking healthful. I'm wanting an extra half inch on the fucking shaft. by the way, I've got a swear list, apparently. I've got a swear list. I don't know how my swearing is this episode so far. But there was a lot of swearing last time. The reason being was that I recorded it late at night. And when I'm tired and my brain's struggling to keep up, the word fuck becomes like a comma. So I'm going, yeah, he went to the fucking... and was fucking... So I will keep an eye on that. But yeah, I had this shot of turmeric, and it reminded me of, if you've seen Rise of Skywalker, there's this moment where Rey calls out to like 1,000 generations of Jedi to be with her, not in that sense. She's a good looking girl. That's what I'm saying. Don't take any liberties, Qui-Gon. And she calls out, and you know they help her. And I sort of felt like when I had this shot of turmeric that all my ancestors were calling me a wanker. Basically, because they're just, what has happened to you, Jeff? And this happens, right? When you live and work in London, the kind of food offer that you have, they have things like Itsu, this kind of Japanese style fast food. And so I went in Itsu the other night, right? I had a gig coming up. I thought, I'll just have something healthy, man. I'm trying to lose weight. Maybe I'll have the Thai low calorie coconut veggie brown sauce fucking vomit box, right? And it was awful. And the worst thing was, about half an hour later, I just felt hungry. I thought, I was just gutted that I didn't get a ham and cheese roll. But I'm losing a little bit of weight, right? I'm losing a little bit of weight. And I know I'm losing weight because I feel angry, a bit tired, and a bit cold, right? Do you ever notice something? You lose your first little layer of fat off you. You just suddenly start feeling cold. You know what I mean? You suddenly start feeling like your wife at night. Just, can you shut that window? Bit nippy in here, just looking for reassurance from everybody else. But that's because essentially with my layer of fat, you know, as I was tipping 13 and a half stone, I was essentially wearing like another coat. That's what fat is, isn't it? It's like nature's coat. I miss it. Anyway, listen, let's get on with the chat now. It's Christopher Snowden here, and we're going to be talking all things nanny state. So, Christopher Snowden there, who, as we are starting the podcast, interestingly, just had a cheeky vape there. Did I see a little cheeky vape?
A little cheeky vape.
Which kind of just brings us immediately to where you're coming from. You are a person that believes in the pleasures of being alive, right? Like the vape, drink, stay out of my fucking business.
Yeah, the drinking, the gambling, the smoking, what have you. Don't smoke, actually, but I'm not against people doing so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, nanny state. Is as you might say, I'm again.
You're not getting, a fan. And it's something that you've written books on and stuff that you've been against your whole life. Is it? I've also thought, just as a point of start, is it a personality thing? This, you know, does it come? Because obviously, as we get older, we all believe our political worldview is this sort of coherent synthesis of the world. But where does it come from in your character?
I sort of remember. At quite a young age, kind of, I don't know, 12 or 13, thinking that there are, you know, there are too many things that you can't do, and that when my generation grew
running
up, we would get rid of them.
Yeah, right?
But, you know, things like the war on drugs, like even then I thought, well, this is crazy that these things are banned, and it won't last for long, and once John Major's out of office, we'll presumably get rid of all this kind of stuff.
Stuffy concerns, right? Get Labour in, and we'll roll back all this.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, to be fair, Labour did have the odd 24-hour drinking thing, which was quite good.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of a libertarian streak in those early years, you know, with a super casino in Blackpool they were going to build,
remember that? Yeah.
Gordon Brown put an end to it.
I mean, it's in Blackpool. It was never going to be a super casino, was it?
It was
just going to be a big casino.
It would have properly regenerated the place, though. I mean, it really would have done. The people in Blackpool were so keen to have it. And Manchester as well. It eventually kind of looked like they were going to have it. And various Puritans and anti-gambling people were celebrating when Gordon Brown got rid of it. But the people in the town, you know, the people who thought they were going to get the casino were not happy at all. I always kind of just assumed that we would be moving in a more liberal direction. And it was a shock to me getting older to find that actually a lot of my generation didn't believe that at all. In fact, thought there was far too much freedom. The reason I
too much freedom. Yeah, it's just as a phrase. Let's just sort of.
Well, they wouldn't put it like that, of course.
They wouldn't.
They'd
think
say
that
there are too many risks or too many hazards or what have you. But I think that it's obviously an issue of freedom. I got into it in a sort of professional capacity, more or less accidentally. I was a very enthusiastic smoker until about 2012, I think, when I switched to vaping. And I was a particularly prolific and enthusiastic smoker when the smoking ban came in. And a couple of years before the UK had a smoking ban, I was in places like New Zealand and a few parts of America where they had smoking bans. And I'd never come across the idea of them before, really, just the idea that you would ban smoking in a pub. I'd never heard anybody say we should ban smoking in pubs. And I was interested in why it happened. And then when the discussion started in Britain and you started hearing Action on Smoking Health say we must have a smoking ban, I go, well, this surely will never happen. And it happened really quickly, you know. And I was interested to see how it... who were these people who were lobbying for this, you know? And I started looking at it from a historical perspective and started reading up on the history of the issue. And there were no books about the history of the anti-smoking movement, but there's quite a lot of books about the history of tobacco and the tobacco industry and that kind of thing. And you could sort of piece it together, the various bits of kind of primary and secondary research, piece together the story of the anti-smoking movement, which went back to literally the kind of the day that Columbus discovered the stuff in America. You know, the first guy from Europe to smoke was imprisoned by the Inquisition for it when he got back to Portugal.
Imagine having to explain that when you get back from your fag break at work.
Well, it was
where you been? Is all you. Nobody expected that.
Well, you can imagine how surprising it would have been for people to see. You know,
it must be. Yeah,
with
it's
no,
an odd action,
no
isn't it,
history
smoking?
Of it whatsoever. Yeah. To see people blowing smoke out of their nose
it's
and mouth.
It's weird. I've often found that I look at people when they're smoking. It's a sort of fascinating, weird thing. And vaping has sort of exacerbated it with these huge smoke rings, and it's almost
those people are annoying. They're ruining it for everybody else. That's why you can't vape anywhere now because of the people blowing out the huge clouds.
Why do you think they do it?
They just get a kick out of it. There's quite a few people, younger people, I would have to say, who they don't even have any nicotine in the vape. They just like doing what they call cloud chasing, and they're blowing huge clouds of this stuff out. So they're not even doing it as
just
a kind of way of...
Yeah,
they just enjoy doing it, I guess.
Do you think they think it communicates, like, dick size?
They're compensating for something.
You don't see any women doing it, in fairness.
It's not just the blokey thing. It's a very specific type of bloke. You know, they've nearly always got beards, black T-shirts, cargo pants. There's a very specific set of people. I've been to a couple of vaping conventions, and it's very similar crowds, sort of like the D&D conventions, you know.
And so you think in a way that like that drives, because there is at the moment, this is one of your current bugbears. You talk about then like obviously the history of prohibition with smoking, but at the moment I see a lot of stuff that you're tweeting and you're, it's a great Twitter account yours, and just simply in terms of keeping up to where the kind of lifestyle prefects are, is that then trying to ban vaping in certain places. And
America especially at the moment,
And that's something you're particularly exercised by.
Yeah, and everyone should be, really. I mean, the beauty about the vaping issue is, unlike all the other stuff I write about, the gambling and smoking and alcohol, you know, there are obviously harms associated with those things. And the kind of libertarian approach is, well, you know, we'll kind of... regulation is not a bad thing. You need to have a certain amount of regulation. We don't want kids doing it, for example. But ultimately, people must be free to decide. And it is an unfortunate consequence that there will always be a small proportion of gamblers, for example, who become problem gamblers, small proportion of drinkers who become problem drinkers, and so on. But the vast majority of consumers actually do never have a problem with it, and we need to try and deal with the kind of problematic minority as best we can without restricting the rights of the majority. With the vaping issue, it's great, because not only have you got a kind of libertarian argument, you've got a very strong health argument. So actually the libertarian approach is not just pro-freedom, it's actually pro-health. And so you have this kind of coalition of people like myself
kind of allied with people like, you know, Public Health England. She's normally one of my, you know, kind of bogeymen, Public Health England. They're wrong about nearly everything else, but they're right about vaping. And they're not pro-vaping because they're pro-freedom, quite obviously. No. They see it, quite rightly, as a very effective way of getting people like myself, who was an, you know, extremely committed smoker, to give up smoking. And so in that instance, the kind of the free market approach actually is a pro-health approach. And in reality, actually, that is often the case in practice, because prohibition can be seen as a sort of public health intervention, a very strong public health intervention, but actually it wasn't pro-health, it led to worse health.
Speaking of health, what are the fears that there's, you hear about popcorn lung,
right? Yeah.
Is that a thing? Is that real?
That is,
I mean, think one of the biggest fears is that people just get really pissed off of you for introducing a weird smell into an environment. I've never...
Which is a reason that a lot of people supported the smoking ban, if we're honest.
Yes.
I'm not sure many people genuinely thought there were a lot of bar workers dropping dead from secondhand smoke. They just didn't like the smell of it. Smokers were a minority, and a dwindling minority.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there was always going to come a point where the, you know, the majority would just say,
"That's true.
We want an end to this." Popcorn lung, I think, is the most popular... Well, not the, it's the most common myth. Apparently, it's very popular on Facebook and places. Popcorn lung is a disease that is associated, or was associated, with people who worked in popcorn factories, because there's a chemical, the name of which escapes me for the moment, there's a chemical used in production of popcorn.
Toffee? Salt?
It's called diacetyl something, I can't remember exactly what it is. And it caused some kind of lung disease in this, you know, very, very heavily exposed subset of the workforce. And the same chemical is used in a much, much lower proportion in certain vape juices. It's actually, in you find it in more concentrated form in cigarettes themselves, but smokers never get popcorn lung, right? It's you have to be exposed to
live long
very, very heavily.
Okay, just butting in a little bit on the chat there. I hope you're enjoying it. Just to hype a few things, really. Obviously, the tour is back underway. There's a few... I just had the latest set of sales figures, and it's looking good, man. It's looking good. There was a lot of tickets sold from when I was on the... Oh, I nearly swore again. Well, yeah, why say the fucking telly, Jeff? There's absolutely no reason for that swear word. But Lyme Regis, 22nd of February, is one that's pushed on but could do with a tickle. Colchester Arts Centre, that's moving now, and that's on the 23rd of February. The Stourport one, I'm going to keep pushing this. There was a little bit of movement, so I don't know if that was the podcast or people saw me getting confused on what I lied to you. I thought, yeah, let's go and see this clown. Wrexham, 7th of March, my only Welsh date of the tour. Hope to see you there. Shrewsbury, have I mentioned Shrewsbury? I'm on the 25th of March, I'm at the Theatre Severn in Shrewsbury. And I have no idea what a Shrewsbury accent is. I know that they got a good result against Liverpool's reserves. But yeah, maybe Shrewsbury's buzzing now. You know, the town is giving them a new lease of life, getting that 2-2 draw against Liverpool's youth team. So that's actually selling well, but you know, let's fill that one. And then Exeter, the 4th of April, at the Northcote Theatre. I'm just excited about this because it's Northcote or the Northcote. There's no specific reason other than that. I'm back in Bath Friday the 3rd of April. Right, I'm back in Bath at the Comedy Festival. We did the Rondo Theatre there, only a small one, sold it out, and we're coming back to a slightly bigger room, and that's all ticking over very nicely. Like I say, there are a few TV things coming up this week, actually. This week, I don't know if I'm able to... So I'm going to be on the news quiz on Friday, so do download that from Radio 4. I might be on Question Time this Thursday, and I might be on another satirical topical news show, panel show on Friday night, but you'll find out about that soon enough. But like I say, if you see me on something on telly, whatever it is, Instagram, Twitter, just try and say something nice. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people up there calling me a twat.
You know, it's interesting what you said about like the risks around gambling and alcohol and the more known entities to us, that most people don't encounter them, you know. And that is something that feels like is lost, isn't it? That most things are characterised by their most... Even like politics, they're characterised by their most extreme ends. But just the overwhelming majority of people are fine with these things. And I think that, like, you know, something like fixed odds gambling machines, right?
Yeah.
This is a question I've always had in my mind, is that if you can basically do your kids' college fund in an afternoon on that, right? You've obviously got a personality type that is drawn to that sort of jeopardy. Mm. Are there any studies or is there any intuition in terms of, right, you just stop fixed odds things. What happens in their character? Because I'm guessing that doesn't just go away. They're already that kind of person.
They just go online, really, and that's what's happening, as far as we can tell. And it's what I said would happen beforehand, and kind of people ignored me. And then literally the day that they effectively banned fixed odds betting terminals, there were people on the radio going, it's great that we banned fixed odds betting terminals, but now we need to clamp down online, because obviously these people are just going to go online. Well, regulating online is a hell of a more difficult than regulating high street bookmakers. The whole question of addiction is fascinating and complex and not even particularly well defined. We have a growing moral panic about gambling in this country, and it's only going to get worse. You can see people are really going for it. Once they've got that win with the old FOBTs, they're now going for gambling advertising, going for online gambling, going for all sorts of stuff, because they feel that they've got a bit of momentum. But the problem gambling rate in this country is about 0.5%, and it has been ever since we've been measuring it. We only started measuring it in 1999. But in those 20 years...
So is that of all gamblers, one in 200 is...
A problem gambler. Okay. Yeah. Problem gambling is assessed by... you just get asked like 12 questions. And yeah. I think it's kind of reasonable, but actually...
Did you have that impulse yourself?
I like a gamble, but I'm not...
No,
I don't think I get addicted to it, you know?
Like the first time I lost like 20 quid.
That teaches you a lesson.
Fuck that.
Like, yeah.
But one of my mates once put it to me that the buzz from gambling was like, he said, you know when you're driving down a motorway and then suddenly like something in front of you breaks unexpectedly and you slam on the brakes and you almost hit it?
Yeah.
He said, that's like a buzz of gambling.
It's like, a combination.
That's a shit buzz.
Yeah, it's a combination of like absolute panic at losing large amounts of money combined with the possibility of winning a lot of money. That weird combination.
Okay.
And that's why the more you stake, the more exciting it is. But not only could you win more, but you can also lose more. That, I guess, is where the excitement is. But most people who've had a bad night in the casino or whatever kind of learn the lesson from it and just go, okay, I'll calm it down. I know a lot of people, and I expect you do too, used to play the fruit machines too much in the pubs. You know?
Yes, yeah,
people,
yeah.
When they first start going to pub, there's always one lad, isn't there? It's like, can you lend us a quid? It's about to pay out.
And you see that look in the eye, don't you? They start calling them the fruities, and there's a fondness in their term. I remember as well, like I do think there's a lot of gender differences in gambling. I think ultimately women, but like my mum used to call going to bingo, having a flutter. So she even gave it a word that kind of like excused her for it. My old man spent a few money, spent 40 quid on beer. Outrageous. She done 40 quid at a bingo. Just flat, it's sociable. And I thought, all right. Like one day I thought, well, yeah, it is so sociable. I'll go down and I'll see her in a natural habitat. She was doing 12 books, right? She wasn't making eye contact of anyone. It was smoking and gambling. That was all it was. There was literally no difference between a bloke standing there. You know those old seedy blokes you used to get at the bookies watching like the greyhound racing. I just thought it's funny, isn't it, that they're able to excuse it that way. And now you get the online ones like Foxy Bingo and the way that it's marketed. I don't see any distinction between bingo and horse racing.
No, it's a form of gambling. Bingo was invented in the 40s, I think, as a way of getting around the ban on lotteries. It's essentially a lottery, right? Bingo.
It's just
a lottery. You're given some numbers and you see which ones come up. But by pretending it's a game, they got around the gambling laws.
Have you ever been to a bingo? Have you ever played like a proper?
No, I don't think I have.
Do you know, it's really funny because like you just get like people call when they're wrong. So like, house.
All right.
House. I mean, it's probably all kind of automated now, but when I went in the late 90s, so this was one in Croydon, and then someone comes around and they go, false claim. You just think those people just haven't kept up or they've got excited.
They're just trolling it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it was like shitposting or something at the bingo. And then they played the National as well, which was like, you know, something like 17 grand. And it was, even then, I don't know how they did the tech on it. It was all coordinated. It'd be like, we have a winner in Manchester. And then obviously London, fucking, man, do you know what I mean? It's never in London, never in London. I do find that now, we do think these things are characterised by who the people that can't handle it rather than the people that can. I mean, like, what we often think about libertarians is, like, is where's your line, right? Do you have a line? Because the truth is that a lot of these things, particularly totally liberalised laws on hard drugs, we know that they're never really going to come in. So we can say it, but the idea of what might happen if it was introduced. Yeah. What do you think would happen if, for example, you could buy cocaine and heroin as a recreational drug in this country? What do you think would happen? Where could I get it?
That wouldn't be my system. My system would be to try to kind of turn back the clock to the 19th century, basically, before there was any kind of prohibition on drugs.
You know? Opium.
Opium, laudanum was very common. Most people, you know, would have taken opium at some point in their lives. A lot of people, especially around the Fens for some reason, used to take a lot of opium. And didn't really have a problem with it.
It's pretty boring. I mean, if anything just introduces a few undulations, then it's probably worth it.
Well, yeah, it's a funny one because there was a huge problem with kind of opium addiction in China, and the anti-opium movement in Britain wasn't about stopping people in Britain taking opium. Nobody really even considered that to be an issue. The anti-opium thing was, I don't know if you know about the opium wars, but we basically forced the Chinese to buy our opium from India in the mid-19th century. And a lot of people in Britain thought that that was kind of immoral, understandably, and that it was a violation of Chinese sovereignty. And so I think it was called the Society for the Suppression of the Opium Trade or something like that. They campaigned very hard to undo that and to respect China's ban on opium. Which they achieved, I think, in 1906. But there was never any kind of movement to ban people in this country from taking drugs themselves. That was the interesting thing. And there was, even though opium, you could buy it in pubs, you know, you can get it anywhere up until about 1868. And even after that, you can still get it from a pharmacy. It never seemed to be a drug of kind of... abuse. There was a big problem with, you know, gin and stuff like that. You've had various kind of
with drugs, there are things that you can obviously do each day, right? But then there's drugs like acid, like ecstasy to avoid. I wonder if it's like that where you go, you know what, that was a lot of fun. Probably not going to do that for a while.
Yeah.
Because it's a bit extreme. And most sensible people may be... Because opium, as I understand it, is a more altered state type drug, a more... You know, you're more incapacitated during the period that you're high on it.
Kind of. It's not as strong, actually, as a lot of people assume, because people kind of get it mixed up with heroin, which is vastly stronger. I don't know. I mean, as I say, I would try and go back to the kind of market that we had in the 19th century when there really wasn't much of a problem, actually, with drug addiction on any real scale. And I appreciate a lot of things have happened since then. There's been a cultural revolution in the 60s and all that kind of stuff. And you can't put the genie back in the bottle. But to cut a long story short, I wouldn't legalise heroin or crack cocaine or crystal meth as such. But I wouldn't ban the component drugs. So I could see a market in which cocaine was an ingredient in certain products. But not necessarily powdered cocaine. And I couldn't stop people from making crack cocaine. It's not very difficult to do if you've got some bicarbonate of soda. But I wouldn't necessarily have it on the market. And maybe some libertarians would say I'm being a fascist by saying
that's
that,
what's
right?
interesting. But, this whole spectrum of
but,
going.
But it's like you can't buy. You can't buy. You can never please a really hardcore libertarians. But you can't go into a shop and buy 100% proof alcohol, right? We have certain kind of standards on that. If you're believe in liberal economics, you want. So you want people to be able to make a genuinely free choice. And there is an issue around addiction on that basis. Are you truly free if you're addicted to a product? It's a serious and important question. But on the other hand, are you free, you know, if something's banned, right? What's a bigger restriction on freedom? Having some people who've got some kind of dependency or just nobody's allowed to buy it whatsoever. Clearly, prohibition is a greater restriction on freedom, but maybe, you know, there are grey areas. I've never taken crack again, but you know, I hear it's extremely moorish, and maybe that is a real restriction on those people's freedom, and you need to have sensible regulation around it. I don't know what the answer is for some of those drugs.
What was interesting growing up, I suppose, you talk about going back to a period before there was such heavy legislation as there is now, is when I first heard about drugs and knew what they were, I just sort of thought, oh, these have always been banned. I think a lot of people intuitively think that. Do you know what I mean? Like, they just came on and they were banned. I was watching, like, the first series of Peaky Blinders, and they were doing Charlie in the Toilet, so you go, oh, yeah, like, this is a thing before. Well, yeah, but, I mean, cocaine wasn't banned. When was cocaine banned in this country?
They were all kind of banned around about 1920. It was all part... It was actually in the... A lot of people don't know this. It was in the Treaty of Versailles.
Was it?
the full legal, like global prohibition of certainly opium was in the Treaty of Versailles. There'd previously been a convention. The Americans basically got together with the Chinese. Cut a very long story short, the Chinese blockaded American ships for quite a long time because the Americans had banned Chinese immigrants coming to America. So it was a tit-for-tat thing. And to try and make friends with China, America got on side and said, we will help you defeat the opium trade and we'll ban the sale of opium and we'll get as many other countries as we can to ban it as well.
So do you think if there's a world war now and there was a modern Treaty of Versailles, would sugar... sugar be one? Because that's something that I've seen you talk about often, and the way that sugar suddenly, because I can remember it's always been different things. I remember it's fat when I was younger. It's cut down the fat in your diet, and then of course people go, oh, actually you do sort of need a bit of fat, and then carbs, and now it seems to be squarely in on sugar. How much moral panic is there around sugar?
It came almost out of nowhere, the sugar thing. You know, it's a very, very recent panic. It wasn't around 10 years ago at all. You know, you're right, it was about fat. You know, Denmark brought in a fat tax in 2011, I think. And
that sounds like something that, you know, when I was at school would be a bullying thing. Fat tax, just take your whisper.
It was a tax on saturated fat and any products that had saturated fat in it. And a lot of nanny states around the world were very excited about this. This is the way forward. And it fell apart because it was incredibly unpopular and there's loads of cross-border trade in Lurpak and bacon and stuff.
You'd think that Denmark all places would
have. Well, right, yeah. All their main products are very high.
Really unhealthy.
So it didn't go down well. But what's interesting is it wasn't a tax on sugar, right? It was a tax on fat. Yeah. That's less than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in that time, the focus has switched enormously from fat to sugar. Action on Sugar was formed about 2014. And they were just incredibly successful. There's only about 3 people in Action on Sugar. It's a tiny little pressure group you could fit in a phone box. But they managed to get themselves on the front pages saying it's a new tobacco. Look at all the teaspoons of sugar in this. Look at teaspoons of sugar in that. Public Health England got on board with a sugar reduction plan. We've now got a sugar tax, of course.
Led to fear. Teaspoons of sugar. Do you remember what they used to say about a rainforest? It was always football pitches.
Belgium.
Yeah, or the size of Wales. Or something like that. And then teaspoons full of sugar. Because is there something misleading about that? Because what they're sort of saying is the idea of you deliberate. Because I'm thinking, God, what would tea taste like that if I put 16 teaspoons full of sugar? But sugar doesn't work like that, does it? It's a nutrient. So that's something I learned from you is... Like, I always thought of it as this evil thing, and then you go, well, actually, it's a really crucial part of a diet.
Did you always think it was an evil thing, or is it just the last few years?
Well, I suppose, I remember, about, Ribena tooth when I was a kid stuff. So there was always a view. My mum, for some reason, seemed to think that anybody that put sugar in tea was sort of evil. But she had sugar in coffee, so it was a completely sort of eccentric take on it. But yeah, I did, and then it's a nutrient.
It's just a carbohydrate. There's nothing special about sugar. There really isn't, other than the potential for tooth decay, right? That's the only difference. Yeah, if you don't brush your teeth and you have a lot of sugar regularly around your teeth, then you're going to have problems. But just brush your teeth, you know? Tooth decay...
I mean, that's the point, personal responsibility. But that sounds radical, doesn't it? Like, it's a... Just brush your fucking teeth.
And people do. And tooth decay is at record lows amongst both children and adults. I mean, the decline in tooth decay since the 1970s is unbelievable.
It's fallen
so steeply. And yet we hear about tooth decay crisis. We're consuming less sugar than we did in the 70s, significantly less.
We're
consuming about
like
the
that.
Same as we did at the start of the 20th century. And people have no idea. This is this kind of myth that... Oh, in your grandmother's day, we just ate, turnips and
square meals.
They didn't. People just didn't. They didn't in your mother's day. They didn't in your great grandmother's day. Mm. Even if you look at Mrs. Beaton's cookbook from the mid 19th century, there's plenty of sugar in there.
Yeah.
It was all desserts, angel delights,
spotted
dick, stuff.
And I would say I've always thought that about the older generation. It might be
they love sugar.
They love.
I love a cake.
It might be an overhang from rationing, perhaps. You know, where they always, my old man, he always spread butter like it was going to be rationed again at any point. Like, there was a degree of... I've sort of since realised that he's right with butter. If you really want to enjoy it, don't fuck about. You know what I mean? But he's also a man who would put salt on bacon, so he's...
it's not salty enough, is it, Rick?
Yeah, and tomato and ketchup on tomatoes. He was strange, kind of radical in his own way, but a lot of things that you said there will be challenging to what most people think, which is that it's not getting worse, but the liberals say everything's getting worse. It's it's getting worse. We're descending towards this fucking toothless, out of the EU dystopia.
Yeah.
But it's not true.
And it's not getting worse. And the only way they can pretend it's getting worse is by moving the goalposts. So yeah. A few years ago, they halved the sugar guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, why they did it is a long story. I've written about it. But basically, there is no scientific basis for halving the sugar guidelines. There isn't really a scientific basis for having sugar guidelines at all, mm-hmm. quite honestly, because it's just a source of calories. There's scientific evidence for saying you should only consume so many calories. But the proportion of it that comes from sugar really doesn't make any difference. Anyway, they halved the guidelines. For no reason whatsoever. And now campaigners go around saying, people in Britain are consuming twice as much sugar as they should. In other words, people are consuming within the old guidelines, but we've changed the guidelines. Right. They do this all the time. There's a constant moving of the goalposts, inventing new things. You know,
yeah.
Problem gambling is not going up, so we've created this new category called at-risk gambling.
Mm.
We've invented pre-diabetes. A lot of this stuff is to help pharmaceutical companies sell more products. You know, mild alcoholism is one that pharma companies tried to get into circulation a few years ago.
This country is founded on mild alcoholism.
Alcoholics are only drink mild, you know.
What most people think.
There's an appetite for panic. You know, good news doesn't sell.
Yeah.
You know, this is why we don't hear about, you know, the number of people who are lifted out of poverty every day around the world. You know, we just hear that there's gross inequality and things are getting worse.
Food banks. That's a
food banks. Yeah, that's the one, right? So the poverty rate hasn't gone down in this country. So food banks, as if it's some kind of measure of anything. You know, it's not, you know, most things in Britain and around the world are getting better. And it makes it difficult to maintain this panic, but it's, you know, the facts speak for themselves.
But a lot of people don't think that, and that's not just on the left, you know, it's an inherent part of the human
condition. People have always thought that, yeah.
Just it's bad and it's getting worse.
Yeah.
That would have been like the underlying sort of sentiment of humanity, even though every graph is going the other way. And it's so, and it's really weird that it's so challenging to people to just say, you know, the global poverty thing. Because what you often find is a lot of people that, you know, the hashtag open borders posse that talk about the global community. If you mention poverty, they seem to only be able to talk about it in parochial terms. So they'll say, yes, but in Britain this has happened. But, you know, leave it aside whether or not that's accurate. Why aren't we taking into account what's happening in China and India? Why is that not of concern to you? Because really perhaps they're not as global as they think.
Yeah, and it's not just them. I think it's really the public in general. You know, people have an appetite for bad news. They don't particularly have an appetite for good news. Newspapers and TV shows have occasionally tried to get people interested in good news. It never works. People just don't want to know. I don't really want to know most of the time. Well, quite honestly, if I pick up a newspaper, I want to hear about, you know, sad things.
But I suppose what we're living with is this weird period is that the liberal left who find themselves struggling to get political power is that they're now cast as the Cassandras of world politics because they're not in power. They have to create... Because it was the Tories once upon a time, you know, broken Britain, you know, everything's getting worse, single mothers. They used to be these people. And it's so weird now. I don't know about you, I find it such a funny sort of optic to get, like, right-wing politicians going, you know, let's just be happy, man.
Yeah,
why does everybody chill out? And then,
well, I think one of... I mean, Labour had a lot of problems, obviously, in the last election, but I think one of them, which they haven't grappled with at all, is that they just assumed that everybody was miserable. They were working in zero-hours contracts.
Yeah.
They were suffering from austerity. And people just didn't feel that because it wasn't really true, right? And you can give as many figures as you want about food banks, but for the vast majority of people, the last 10 years actually hasn't been that bad.
No.
The last decade is the first one since the... probably for 100 years, had no recession. Now, growth wasn't great, but it didn't have a recession. We got record low unemployment.
Mm.
For a lot of people who've got a mortgage, you know, having, you know, historic low interest rates has been a pretty good thing. Now, obviously, not everything in the garden is rosy, but for people like Jeremy Corbyn to come out and just assume that everyone's miserable, everyone's working in the gig economy and can't stand it. And it doesn't cut through with people because it's not their lived experience.
No, I mean, 0 hours, like most of the research done about 0 hours, people appreciate the flexibility.
People mostly like it, yeah.
But this is just because, I suppose, if you're in a weird way, and you do find people on the liberal left that like this now, they tend towards a certain patrician, you know, like, I know, we've got to look after these poor people in the 0 hours economy. They don't credit them with having any agency. And
it's just casual labour. Yeah,
exactly.
The 0 hours contracts, I think I kind of looked into this and how often the term was used. yeah. Like on the internet and in newspapers and stuff like that. It was never used at all excuse me, until about 2013. Hmm. Ed Miliband got it into circulation. And after that point, its use rose exponentially. But the number of zero-hours contracts hadn't risen exponentially. Mm. The Office of National Statistics didn't really measure it. They obviously didn't measure it and then call it zero-hours contracts. It's just casual labour. And the research that we have on it shows that actually the vast majority of people in zero-hours contracts are happy, A, with their job. They don't want more hours. It suits them perfectly. My sister-in-law's on supposedly zero-hours contracts. She loves it. And I told her that Labour were talking about banning it. She was genuinely horrified. She goes, no, I love it. I can work from home. I do the hours when I want. I've got three kids. I need to pick them up. I need to be flexible. Yeah.
But again, it's
she's basically just employed to do something, and she can do it when she wants. That's a zero-hours contract.
But it's about the state going, I know better than you right now. Like, whatever your lived experience is, I'm a state, and I'm thinking about banning things, despite the evidence that people like it. I think, in a way, 0 hours work is just a resurgence of that thing that we once knew, was like ducking and diving.
Right.
You know? Yeah. We touched briefly upon, like, party politics there. Is your party politics quite sort of transit? Do you sort of go towards who the most libertarian guardians are?
Well, sort of. I mean, I'm kind of anti-socialist, so yeah, it doesn't okay. give you much of a choice these days, you know, really. I mean, there isn't... I'm like most libertarians, I'm a man without a party. I wish that the Liberal Party was genuinely liberal. Mm. You know, I think maybe that's how they could get themselves back on the feet, is by, you know, going for that gap.
It's such an interesting point. That wouldn't occur to them. They think their thing is to be more, you know, to go for these kind of virtue signalling social media posts.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you know, the Conservative Party... They've got form in terms of overreach themselves. I mean, there's a lot of things they've been considering recently. The porn pass was one example. Are there any other examples?
Well, they've done the sugar tax. They've done loads of nanny state stuff. I mean, Cameron was terrible for it. May was even worse. You know, they're not. The lesser of two evils, really, when compared to the current Labour Party. But, you know, I joined the Labour Party in 96 when I was at university. Didn't go to many meetings. I got a rosette on me outside the polling station. I did the exit poll for a couple of hours, May the 1st, 1997. One of the reasons was I just thought the Tories were too paternalistic and authoritarian.
Yeah.
And in many ways, they were. I just didn't realise what, you know, Labour were going to turn into. But from my point of view with the nanny state, the slash public health stuff, I mean, they're both pretty much as bad as each other, really. I think under Boris Johnson, maybe things will get better. But it seems like there's a cross-party consensus on this stuff, pretty much.
Well, they think that the force is with them. You often see that when they stand up and talk on these issues, that especially when right-wing politicians do it. It's like their moment to be a good person. Mm. And I think
they like these big projects. It's the same with climate change. They don't like the idea of saving thousands of lives and saving the planet. You know, these people, a lot of them haven't got... A lot of MPs didn't really go into politics for any particular political objective, you know?
No.
Some did.
They want a sense of mission.
But a lot of the ones who did only went in for, you know, they've got two things they want to achieve, and if they're a backbencher, they're going to be bloody lucky to do either of them, and they're not that bothered about anything else. So they like the idea of a stroke of a pen saving thousands of lives or delivering thousands of children from a life of, you know, nicotine addiction or gambling addiction or whatever it may be, and of course saving the planet with net zero. And what all these things have in common is very low political cost. You know, Theresa May saying we're going to decarbonise the economy completely by 2050, by which time she'll be certainly retired and not dead, right? It's completely painless. It's pretty much virtue signalling for the MPs just to go and go, yeah, we'll do 2050. And it's equally virtue signalling for Corbyn to go, we'll do it by 2035 or whatever, 2030. Mm. And Climate Extinction Extinction Rebellion to go, we'll do it 2020. You're not going to do anything.
We'll
do
it by Thursday. We'll all be Amish. That's the easiest way.
I mean, you can say what you like, but you're not actually going to do it. You haven't got a plan to do it. Extinction Rebellion certainly haven't got a plan to do it. And it's a bit similar with the public health stuff. They know that this stuff is neither massively popular nor, generally speaking, massively unpopular, but they can just do it. Go, okay, we'll bring in plain packaging for tobacco. We won't bother kind of assessing whether it made any difference at all in the future. We'll just move on to the next thing. Up in Scotland, we'll do minimum pricing. And, you know, we look good, we're a world leader. They love that bit, you know. Mm. It's always countries like Scotland or Australia or whatever, like we are the world. Ireland love the being a world leader. Ever since Ireland banned smoking, became the first country to ban smoking, they've been looking to be world leader on all this
stuff. You know, like in Guinness Book of Records, where it's like, right, what's a record that hasn't been broken? What's that? Yeah, kind of, I'll do that. I mean, in a weird way, is it like, does it feel like, I wonder if it feels like more of a betrayal when a right-wing party get involved in this, because you think, like, if you've got any chance at the moment of more libertarian tendencies. I do think that you're right about the Liberal Party and Conservatives. It's the most underserved constituency in politics is libertarians, I think. There's a lot of people that feel this way instinctively across the left-right divide, but no open pitch has ever been made to them. Why would that be? Is it just not smart enough to realise the audience for it?
Some of the Tories kind of do it with a nod and a wink, don't they? You know, and some of the Tories genuinely are kind of more or less classically liberal, but it's a bloody broad church, the Tory Party. Any party that's big enough to encompass Philip Davis and Sarah Wollaston is a very broad church indeed. Yeah. You know.
Listen, Chris, it's always fascinating to chat, mate. Obviously, you've still got your books are still out. They can be got on Amazon. Anything else you need to push at this point?
You can download my last book, Killjoys, for free from the IEA website.
And like I say, well worth a follow on Twitter if this kind of thing has piqued your interest, because, it's basically, like, you know, as you've seen from the live show, first 10 minutes of it is based on stuff that you pointed out. So, Christopher Snowden, thank you so much for coming on What Most People Think.
Absolute pleasure, Jeff.
Okay, so that was the chat with Chris Snowden there. Hope you enjoyed that. It's always, whenever I have a chat with Chris, I come away feeling a little bit smarter and a little bit more kind of vilified about my suspicion of the big state. We're just going to do some letters here, just a couple of letters quickly this week. We had one from Mike W. Thank you, Mike. He was watching the Test cricket on the BBC Live Text. It's a great way to watch cricket. Some people say the very best. And there was a guy that texted in from Verwood. So this is the ongoing investigation as to whether Verwood is a place. And there was a guy, I mean, it doesn't prove anything. The guy just claimed to be from Verwood. Do you know what I mean? I could claim to be from Tatooine, right? I always get a Star Wars reference in. But we are building a portfolio, a dossier of evidence that Verwood exists. Also had a letter from Big Jim here. I don't know where Big Jim comes from, but come on, he's got to be Scottish with a name like Big Jim. So let's do the most big bastard Scottish accent we can do. Hey Jeff, I was listening to Radio 4 and heard that businesswoman talking about banning footy chat in the workplace. What's going on, mate? We can't you chill out? I reckon with a lot of these uptight people, they just haven't yet had sex for a while. I don't know if you saw this. It was this businesswoman, I can't remember her name, Alison. I mean, you know, Alison sounds like the kind of woman that would... No offence to any Alisons, right? But yeah, she was saying that there's so much football chat in the workplace, it can make the workplace very laddish. Because obviously being laddish is a bad thing, you know? You wouldn't be able to say that about girlish, would you? Oh, it's very girlish. You can't say that about women. But laddish, what's wrong with you? You can be a good lad or a bad lad. Laddishness in itself isn't the issue, all right? Laddishness is only when you've hired a couple of dwarfs and you're firing them at a massive dartboard. Yeah, with strippers. That's bad. That's bad. You know, when you've gone full Wolf of Wall Street, laddish. it was very strange. Very strange what she said, that she just didn't like hearing blokes talk about football. What you got to understand, right, is that, man, we struggle communicating at the best of time. And this might sort of segue nicely into a little bit of men's mental health here, is that men do sometimes like to talk in code, right? We don't like to get straight to the heart of it, because it's sort of boring, isn't it? You meet up, okay, how are you? How's the family? Yeah, how's the kid? How's the dog? Sort of, we pad our way around it in the form of sports points. You know, I'm telling you what kind of man I am by the way that I analyse sport. And as I say out loud, I do realise this is mentally probably quite unhealthy. So if men, what are men supposed to do? You know what I reckon? I reckon she's one of these old-fashioned workhouse types that really, it doesn't really matter what people are talking about. All she sees is lack of productivity, right? It's a cynical fucker. She's tried to peg it into feminism when really all she wants is more bang for a buck, yeah? And Big Jim thinks that maybe it's a lack of sex that's making us so uptight in the first place. What most people think. So finally, a political fight. Now, this one was from Andrew, who's from Wigan, and he's noticed a few other people doing this. A few other people are talking about the political fight thing. So I'm glad that people see it as a good little format point, as ever. I always like to slightly be ahead of the curve and thinking about other things. And so Andrew pointed out, who would build a tent quickest out of the Labour leadership hopefuls, right? I think that's an excellent sort of spin on it. So let's have a think about it, right? So we've got Rebecca Long-Bailey. I think she'd be quite an organised tent builder. I think Rebecca Long-Bailey would have been up till 3 a.m. looking at YouTube tent building tutorials. And then actually when it comes to it, none of that really helps, and she is it's an absolute fucking mess, right? Lisa Nandy, I think that she tries to seem get up and go. I do not think she's getting anywhere near the tent building process. I think she gets her fella in. And, you know, you might say that that's a bit sexist. I'm just saying, that's how she strikes me. I think she's that. Not all women are like that. Oh, hey, who am I kidding? When it comes to tents being put up, in the history of time, let's do a YouGov on that, yeah? Let's find out what percentage of tents have been erected by women. I'll be interested. I'm thinking 18%, maybe. So I'm thinking Lisa Nandy is one of those women that doesn't... It's not a great tent putter-upper. Keir Starmer. Would he be? Yeah, I think he would. And it's not just because he's a bloke. He's that kind of bloke, isn't he? He's got the waterproofs, Keir. You know, he did it with his dad. He had a constructive relationship with his dad, Keir. I get that impression. Him and his dad out there putting up tents out in nature, right? Talking to... I reckon Keir would put up a good, solid tent. It would be a bit of a glamping sort of tent. Do you know what I mean? It would have like a meditation room or something. So there would be that he'd put his metropolitan spin on it. Emily Thornberry. Yeah, I think you get a couple of sherries in her. I think she'd give it a go, and she. I think she'd want to start off like you know, power to the people, elbow grease. I'm a normal person. She'd drink, and then eventually she'd just hire a bloke to do it. And then the bloke would be someone who has a St. George's flag out of his house, and it'd all be a bit awkward. So out of those, I'm thinking Starmer, he's got the muscle and he's got the know-how. Okay, that is pretty much the end of episode 25 of What Most People Think. If you do have reactions to the stuff that's been said here or stuff you want to follow up on, write in a letter via email, which makes sense, which is whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com. I do like looking in there and responding to those. We just got a couple of reviews, as always. If you leave me a 5-star review, there's a good chance I'll read out a couple every week, and there's a good chance it will be yours, because there generally are a couple every week. This is from Stephen TR11. I don't know if he's some sort of Terminator. Long time listening, first time commenter. I said he's a Terminator. Should I do this as Arnold? I can't. This is my first ever attempt at an Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation. I've been listening to this since the first episode. I listen to lots of podcasts, but I never felt the need to review one. I feel like Jeff needs it more than most. Kidding. Get it to the chopper. Okay, that was awful. That was up there with how bad the Yoda was. I don't know where I get off thinking I can just like freestyle an impression. Get it to the chopper. Okay, I'm doing an impression of someone doing an impression now. So this guy, the next one, hard work and honesty pays. That sounds like you know, one of those things that could be like gently negging you. So this is from Biggles. So I'm going to think he sounds like a Spitfire pilot. Been following Jeff for years, and from being a right-wing novelty act wheeled out on programs like The MASH Report, probably to meet quotas, it's very pleasing. I don't mind a quota. Just so you know, whatever gets me on the TV. I will say this, right, and this is going to be unpopular with a lot of people that listen to this. MASH Report gets a lot of stick among my followers. They were the first show to ever give somebody right of centre a regular slot on a show. Now, I know that the politics is, you know, can be somewhere left of fucking, you know, like the hard left, but sometimes, and it's very Remainy, but I think they deserve, you know, I've got to stand up a bit. I'm probably going to lose friends for that, but anyway. It's very pleasing to see him becoming mainstream and getting, hopefully, the rewards he deserves. Unlike the virtue-signaling left-wing comics still dominate the airwaves, Jeff appears so stubbornly stuck to his principles to the annoyance of many, and long may it continue. He really does say what people think, as this podcast says on the tin, and he's leading the way in an anti-woke resistance. Well, I'm glad you like it, Biggles. Like I say with the woke thing, yeah, I do end up, you know, sort of drilling down on a lot of things that's coming from the woke side of things. But, you know, I'm anti-shit ideas, and there's been a fair few coming from the woke thing. But it's not just their preserve, so... But thank you so much for that review. And listen, man, I will be back in 2 weeks in the new Garden of Eden. It's Britain, outside of the EU, but still kind of in the EU. Outside of the EU, but, you know, in a transition period. But outside of the EU, but even when we do get outside, I know that's a new trade agreement. But outside the EU...